us on the Portwood Class Program, which is a program in which we invite high school students from all over the state to join us in listening to oral argument and then meet with a justice at noon. This is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And we have with us Roncalli High School students. Would they stand, please? It's good seeing you all, and your school comes every year to this program, and we appreciate that. Please be seated. We also have with us the University of Wisconsin Law Society, and those students here, would they stand? Thank you. We appreciate your presence. You may be seated. And we also have the UW Legal Studies Association. Would those students stand? Thank you for coming. Have you all received materials about the case you're about to hear? So you're familiar with it? You're not. Do we have any? They're outside. You can get some for them if you would, and then distribute to those who do not have the materials so that you can quickly read about the case. I think it will help you understand that. Delighted you came, and I'd like to introduce the court to you. I'll start on the far left because you'll meet at lunch with Justice Sykes, and she's at the far left. And seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions made, we'll now call our second case today, 02-0574, In Re Determination of Parental Rights to Ariana R.G., Sheboygan County Department of Human Services versus Neil J.G. We have Timothy Ankles, who is representing Neil J.G. Attorney Probus.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I guess I should say my name, Tim Probus. I wrote the briefs for appellant Neil G. And first off, I must make a glaring, embarrassing admission in my briefs. I usually try to have a separate heading that says standard of review, and I did not include that. And since we are applying a statute to a set of undisputed facts, the standard of review would be de novo, so you can warn me about that one. I tried to make an impression the last time I was here with Evelyn C.R. and Tequila S., and I quoted from Samuel Johnson that on legal arguments that the more there are of precedents, the less discussion there is of principles. And at this level, of course, we don't have a controlling principle that's a precedent. That's why we're here. So I try to focus my brief argument on a couple of principles and then get to the questions of this very active court. I guess I should be crystal clear, the issue I have raised on appeal is that the trial court did not comply with what I believe should be the proper interpretation of the notice provision, that is 25 U.S.C. section 1912 of the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA. And in a statutory interpretation case, of course, the first principle is to find the intent of the legislature. It's easier in this case than to some others because the Congress set out in two statutes, section 1901, first congressional findings, and in section 1902, declaration of policy. I'll just read briefly from 1902. Congress hereby declares that it is the policy of this nation to protect the best interests of the Indian children, and in my case, the key line is, and to promote the stability and security of Indian tribes, et cetera, et cetera. So, it's clear from these snatches in the legislative history, which is briefly at the beginning of the Mississippi Choctaw case, which is the only U.S. Supreme Court case discussing this statute, that this is a remedial statute, and the objects that are to be remedied was breaking up of Indian families and tribes disappearing from the earth as a result. So, the first principle of statutory interpretation is that remedial statutes are to be liberally construed to affect the object of to affect the remedy. The second principle that applies, this court has already discussed the second principle in a case now known as IP versus State and formerly known as In Re DSP, where it mentioned that the Bureau of Indian Affairs guidelines with respect to the statute should be considered. Now, I guess I'm a picky sort of appellate attorney. I would have preferred that court to have said that this is an administrative interpretation by the agency in charge of interpreting the statute and therefore should be given great weight. In a case I did in the Court of Appeals called the Brown County versus Marcella G., we had an issue of interpretation, and the Court of Appeals there did extensively follow the guidelines, and that's my position here on this issue. The final principle that Professor Sutherland, whose treatise is now in the sixth edition and done by Professor Singer, Sutherland on Statutory Construction, he devotes a chapter, chapter 54, to what he calls the equity of the statute. This court in previous years has called that the spirit of the statute, and that sometimes the spirit of the statute, as it reveals the intention of the legislature, must prevail over the specific words. So, applying all of that to my contention, my feeling is if you read 1912 as a whole, while it does not say that the trial court or the party must inform every conceivable tribe, it clearly, if you get the equity of the statute or the spirit of the statute, is clearly meaning to that we'll make every effort to give actual notice to a tribe or some tribes.
Can I just in
sure
in the record?
Yes, sir.
Because it's the father making the assertions.
Yes.
What you have? Let me know. What is there that to believe that these children are Indian children, other than the assertion that the mother was born on an Indian reservation in Canada, and that the tribe came from Marinette, Wisconsin?
Yes, well, precisely that's all there is in the record, Your Honor. The statute, according to the guidelines,
so is a simple assertion sufficient?
To trigger notice, yes, Your Honor, under the BIA guidelines. Would you want me to read from the guidelines, Your Honor, on that point? Like, I'm assuming you've already read them. the statute does not, well, I guess, I don't, is it fair for me to be, I guess since Justice has raised this, is it fair for me to be talking about her issue before she gets a chance to put it on? I guess so. The statute does not put any burden of proof on any party to trigger the notice provision. The statute simply says when the judge knows or has reason to know, and in fact the guidelines ask that the judge will, guidelines recommend the judge will make inquiries to satisfy itself whether or not there's reason or reason to know. Now,
Sir Provost, let me, if I might, follow up on Justice Wilcox's question. 25 U.S.C. 1903-4 yes. specifically defines Indian child.
I thought you would be the one to bring that up. That's all right, prepared for that. Yes, she...
Let me complete my question.
Yes.
The definition indicates is the person to be an Indian child has to be under the age of 18 and either a member of an Indian tribe or be eligible for membership in an Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of an Indian tribe. Now, why shouldn't the threshold question here be whether or not these children fit within that definition before we get into the notice provision, guidelines, etc.?
Well, indeed, that is the threshold question, and in Indian law, it is the tribes who decide their own membership.
But there's nothing, you just told Justice Wilcox, there's nothing on this record that says anything in terms of eligibility for membership, biological child of a member of an Indian tribe, whether or not the children involved here are members of...
Well, I agree completely, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is, and some of the cases I've cited in the briefs, perhaps all too briefly, point out that there's a basic principle of Indian sovereignty in which Indians decide who are members of their tribe. Now, the reason you give this notice is twofold. It's one, to find out if, when there is doubt, to find out if the person is a member or eligible to be a member. So, I mean, Your Honor, you simply can't, consistent with legislative history and with cited cases, you simply can't have, well, I hope I'm not going to offend anybody, white man's courts deciding who are Indians and who are not.
Don't you have to at least have something on the record to indicate that this child or these children in this case would fit within the definition of Indian child?
Well, the guidelines say, I quoted these guidelines in my reply brief, these specific ones, because they address directly your question, and I'll whip out my reply brief. The guidelines say they provide a non-exclusive list of circumstances which the state court has reason to believe a child involved in child custody proceeding is an Indian. Guidelines are found at 44 Fed Regs 67586, and this is from paragraph B1C. Now, I can read all of these, Your Honor, but I'm assuming you already read them.
Okay, just tell us the summary. What is it in those guidelines that you think trigger that this child is of Indian ancestry?
In my case, it's rule number 5. An officer of the court involved in the proceeding has knowledge the child may be an Indian child.
What gave them knowledge here?
In this case it was my client's trial counsel speaking to his mother. And his mother was directed by the court to speak to social services and provide whatever information she could about Indian heritage.
She provided some information.
Yes, she provided what she knew.
What did she know?
As far as I know, all she knew was her grandma had been... It wasn't her grandmother, wasn't it? Her grandmother had been an Indian on a reservation in Canada, and that she ended up still an Indian, of course, in a Marinette. And this was in 1880.
That was enough. And then, in your view, that's enough to have triggered inquiry, right?
Triggered notice. And, well, okay, and maybe this is not to interrupt you, Your Honor, did you? As I pointed out in my reply brief, the court could find that whether there was sufficient to trigger notice is moot because the court here issued orders that notice be given.
Okay. So the court took various steps to make inquiry, right?
Yes, the court, as I said, ordered the mother of my client to give what information she could from Social Services, or probably ordered Social Services to get that information.
And then what did Social Services do?
This information was turned over to the district attorney, who then did give notice under the statute to the Secretary of Interior.
Right. What did the Secretary of Interior say?
They dropped the ball, basically, in my view. They came back, they wrote back, and they said, well, look, we haven't got enough information to make our determination. So it's back in, ball's back in your court. Now, I would note the letter that they answered the district attorney with, in the record, it's huge and has 8 or 9 attachments, in which I assume the BIA was expecting to help inform the district attorney about his duties. And, of course, I might as well raise it here, because I have, in that package of attachments, there's an attachment that I've referred to in the reply brief, which lists all of the recognized tribes, and their names and addresses, and does list the Chippewa tribes.
All the recognized tribes in Wisconsin or in this part
in,
of the
in world. In the state, in the United States.
Okay. That's all right, Counselor.
There are 500 plus tribes.
But the Chippewas, of course, are identified by name, and I believe there's at least 6 in Wisconsin. There were a couple in Minnesota.
Now to get to the point.
Yes, sir.
What is it you want the court to have done? Where did the court err?
After they got the list back with the names. I mean, I seem to recall in the transcript the judge saying, well, there's all these Chippewas. I know of Chippewas here and there and the underwear, but district attorney did enough. That's it. After they got the list of names back from the BIA, all they had to do was send letters to those 6 or 8 or whatever tribes that were listed as Chippewas.
And that's where the error occurred.
Yes, Your Honor, I cannot believe that the history of this statute and the cited cases, the purpose of it, can allow notice to be given when no tribe ever actually gets any notice. Justice Bradley was ready to.
Yes, I want to return to those guidelines.
Okay.
Now, the guidelines don't have the effect of law in this state, of course, but...
Or any other state here.
That's right. But we have referred to them, I think, in the interest of DSP and others.
Yes, Your Honor.
To be assistance in our
assistance, yes, sir.
So let's see what these guidelines say. It says, number in one... It says in B1A, when a state court has reason to believe a child involved in a child custody proceeding is an Indian, is it your understanding of the guidelines that the court is to make a threshold determination as to whether or not the child is an Indian?
Well, no. The court, the way the guidelines phrases it, specifically in terms of the notice, I'm reading, this is B2, the commentary to B2. This is over on... 67587. Commentary to B2 says, guidelines requires the court to notify all tribes that are potentially the Indian's tribe. So, I'm sticking with the guidelines, Your Honor. The ones that were in my reply brief that I was mentioning in answer to the Chief Justice's question, they list circumstances, non-exclusive circumstances, which the court should consider provide sufficient reason under the statute.
Okay, let me try this way. as I understand the guidelines, first of all, there has to be something brought before the court to give the court, as the guidelines use the phrase, reason to believe. And that something can be several things, and those are set out in the guidelines, including what you referred to, that an officer of the court involved in the proceedings has knowledge that the child may be an Indian. And once, that's sub 5 that you referred to, once an officer of the court involved in the proceedings has knowledge that the court may be an Indian.
No, that the child may be an Indian.
Excuse me, that the child may be an Indian, thank you. Then that seems to be arguably is sufficient for the court to have reason to believe a child involved in the proceeding is an Indian. As I read the regulations, the court is not then to make any determination, but rather the court then is to make sure that notice is given to either the BIA or the Indian tribe, and that their determinations on the issue as to whether or not the child is an Indian are to be given a conclusive effect.
I read those guidelines exactly as you have, Your Honor.
That's what I want to know.
Now, there would be a situation. It doesn't come up in this case, I don't think, because we didn't get that far. But there would be a situation where the either the tribe comes back and says, I don't know what you're talking about, we can't make any determination, or the BIA, after actually examining some evidence, says, you know, we can't find out what the status of this person. At that point, after there's been a return where the tribe has actually had some input, then I would say, if my client still wanted to contend the children were Indian, then he would have a burden of proof to show. Because then, as you say, the determination is conclusive. If they can't make any determination, well, then the court would have to do something then. But here, there's been no input from the tribe.
Well, yes, sir. My question, what tribe?
The Chippewa tribe, Your Honor. Like you say, there are 6 or 7 of them. Now, I don't know. I was never a district attorney.
In Wisconsin, what about the ones in Minnesota?
Well, if it was up to me, Your Honor, I would say them as well, anyone named Chippewa. But let's put it this way, Your Honor. If I had gotten this case and I had found that in response to the BIA letter, the district attorney had written any tribe that was a Chippewa, I would not have brought this case because I would have thought that he would have fulfilled the statutory command.
Can we go back to the threshold question about whether there was a sufficient reason to believe on this record that this child met the definition of Indian child for purposes of the federal statute? The definition, as has been referenced by other members of the court, has 2 parts that will satisfy it. And the first one is that there is reason to believe that the child is a member of an Indian tribe. Was there anything on the record to provide reason to believe that this child was a member of an Indian tribe?
The only...
Not just had Indian blood, but that was a member of the Indian, Indian tribe.
What's on the record is what Justice Wilcox said was on the record. It's right there. That's it. There's nothing more, and I'm not going to argue that there was anything more. What I'm saying is that that information is sufficient to trigger the notice provision under the guidelines.
Why?
Well,
does it raise an inference or a suggestion or a possibility that
yes,
this was...
That is all that's necessary under this act. This act comes out of... you can read the part of the legislative history in the Mississippi Choctaw case. This act comes out of a milieu of hundreds of years of stomping all over Indians. So part of this act is an attempt to remedy that, and I can pretty much my general feeling about it is the reason these guidelines are written the way they are is the state courts are to bend over backwards to comply with the act and to give the tribe a chance, the tribes a chance to have input.
What we have on the record, as I understand it, is the suggestion that this child is descended from a person who was born on an unknown Indian reservation in Canada.
Yes, Your Honor, that's it. And in one of the cases I cited in my brief, the Colnar case from, I forget the state it was, what they had there was the mother had asserted that somebody was one quarter Apache. That was it. So, mother said somebody is one quarter Apache. And the court there went through the same things I'm going through here and said, I think we should remand and have all appropriate Apache tribes informed.
But we don't even have that here. We have the suggestion that this child is descended from someone who was born on an Indian reservation, not born on an Indian reservation to a tribal member.
Again, the issue of who is a member of the tribe is exclusively that of the tribe. The tribe makes that decision under Indian law, recognized by our U.S. Supreme Court since Indians
were... Right, I understand that.
So they are the only one who can make a conclusive determination one way or the other.
Right, but what we have to decide here is what triggers the notice requirement that the court give notice to the tribe to allow it to make that decision. And it's got to be something. And
well, there it is, Your Honor. That's what's in the record, and I say that's sufficient under the guidelines. I couldn't convince you of anything different if you want to ignore the guidelines. Sure. But I think this court has already set itself on a course where it's not going to do that. However, like I said, I'm a picky appellate lawyer, and I would wish that the court would say that these guidelines are administrative interpretation of a statute by the agency which is charged with its enforcement and therefore are entitled to great weight. Because that's the standard statutory interpretation principle.
Even if we give it great weight, isn't the issue whether this information is enough to trigger more inquiry than was given?
Now, that's interesting. Did I hear you to say, Your Honor, that based on that, then you wanted the judge to be holding more hearings or something?
I'm asking you, is that your position?
No.
All right.
Definitely not.
If not more hearings, then more notice. Your position is to give more notice.
Yeah, see, the initial, there were two motions here that my client made. First one brought the issue up, and then in response to that, the judge says, okay, Mama, go talk to social services. Then district attorney gave the notice. Notice came back, we can't figure it out. BIA response came back, we can't figure it out. So, but, like I said, listing the tribes. So, then, counsel made a second motion. And my feeling is that in response to the second motion, since the court had the addresses before it, it is not an onerous burden. And, in fact, what the spirit of the statute means is that all those potential tribes would be notified by the DEA before the proceeding continued. And then if they, you know, the tribes came back and says, hey, it was 1880, we don't know anything, then it would be a different matter.
What do you want us to do? You want us to remand this and notify those tribes? And
yes, Your Honor.
Say, unless, if these tribes say they don't know of this family and they don't know of these children, then the termination is okay. Is that your position?
That's probably what would happen. That's what I'm asking for, is remand for proper notice.
Are there guidelines on how much time a tribe has to respond?
Mm-hmm. I think that's in the statute, Your Honor. You've caught me flat-footed here. counsel's assistant to hear. And where's that from? Oh, cool. Down in the, 19, section 1912. I guess you've already read it, haven't you, Your Honor? It says, no foster care placement or termination proceeding shall be held until at least 10 days after receipt of notice by the parent or Indian contestant and the tribe or the secretary. So at a minimum, they've got 10 days.
The tribe is 10 days.
According to 1912, the plain meaning.
Okay, counsel, thank you. Your time is up. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Assistant District Attorney Mary T. Wagner, representing the Sheboygan County Department of Human Services.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Wagner. I'm Assistant District Attorney for Sheboygan County. I represent the Sheboygan County Department of Health and Human Services in this matter. This case should not be remanded back to the tribal court for further notification under the Indian Child Welfare Act because no such notice was required in the first place. No provisions of the federal statute were triggered because, under the facts of the case, the trial court did not know or have reason to know that the child, or rather the children, Ariana and Hunter, were Indian children within the meaning of the federal statute. Now, in order for any of the provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act, including the notice provisions, to apply, the trial court has to know or have reason to know that the child is an Indian child. Now, there are two specific statutory criteria for this. Either the child involved has to be a member of an Indian tribe that is eligible for benefits through the United States Secretary of the Interior, or one of the child's biological parents has to be a member of the tribe, and therefore the child is eligible for membership, him or herself. In other words, the federal law is limited to children who either belong to a tribe or have a parent who belongs to a tribe. Now, when the Act applies, it confers automatic jurisdiction in these matters of foster care placement and termination, pre-adoptive and adoptive placement for the Indian tribes, for Indian children who are residing on or domiciled on the reservation. That's a no-brainer. If the child is on the reservation, the tribal court automatically has jurisdiction. It also, in Section 1911B, confers permissive jurisdiction on the tribal courts in such actions where an Indian child is the subject of a termination proceeding or one of these other proceedings that has arisen in state court. In that case, if the child is an Indian child and notice has been sent out and a tribe responds, the state court must transfer jurisdiction upon the request of the parent or the Indian custodian or the tribe unless there is good cause to the contrary or if one of the parents objects.
Well, here there isn't any evidence that the parent is a member of the tribe or that the children we're talking about are members of the tribe. I think that's conceded. But what the opposing counsel wants is to find out if there's anything out there. Now, the trial court, I think from the briefs that we received, certainly this court might be able to make a decision in that area, but would it be more appropriate to have the evidentiary finding, the fact-finding body, which is the trial court, to make a decision on whether or not these were not Indian children? In other words, we talked about remanding back, and your opposing counsel seemed to think that was a good idea. On the other, what about a finding by a lower court that these were not Indian children? We have, he said, opposing counsel said, well, you have what you have. You know what you have, and that's it. And
That actually may be helpful, I guess, now that this is the first time I've thought about it. I know the trial court leapfrogged over the issue of whether the children were Indian children. And it went straight in an abundance, I believe in an abundance of caution, to asking the department to determine whether any such notice, whether the children were Indian children and whether notice should be sent out. And so there was never a technical finding by the trial court that the children were Indian children, only that had there been, that sufficient notice was provided. So as a threshold matter, I guess the trial court never did that. This claim, as we have discussed, is based on the appellant Neal's ancestry, the children's great-great-grandmother having been identified as being born on an Ojibwa reservation in Canada somewhere in the 1880s. As, I'm sorry, I forgot which of you noted this, Neal himself has not claimed any membership in a tribe, nor has anyone stood up in court and said that the children are members of a tribe. There is a national...
Child only have to be a biological child of a member of the tribe. What does that mean? Does it mean a son or daughter? Does
yes.
it mean a grandson or granddaughter? Does it mean a great-grandson and a great-granddaughter? What does it mean,
it was,
biological child?
It was always my understanding that it was a son or daughter of a tribal member. Now, there is a national... I'm sorry.
Are you finishing the chief's question? I think you are.
What does it mean to be a member?
Some tribes have enrollments, written enrollments, and some don't. So how do you show that it's membership?
That, Your Honor, I don't know. I believe that is conclusively the determination of the tribe itself as to whether an individual is a member or not.
And that's why I'm kind of exploring it. And if I say that I'm an Ojibwe Indian, is that enough? Do I have to show enrollment records? Do I have to submit an affidavit that my tribe does not keep written enrollment records or didn't prior to 1980, but I'm a member of it? What do you need to show for that? Or is an averment by counsel, an officer of the court involved in the proceedings, that the child may be an Ojibwe Indian sufficient?
I don't have a list of technical requirements at the ready here for an answer to that. What I would think, what I believe, is that somewhere along the line, and if I could take a step back here and recognize that in these termination proceedings, these are always the most heartbreaking of cases, and we are, overall, in the final analysis, dealing with a child's life and a child's future. And so if there's any place where absolute rigid statutory construction should be allowed to flex in the interest of a little humanity, this would be where it would be.
In fact, that there's a mandate that these be construed liberally.
Yes.
To effectuate that. Is that
yes.
Correct?
But it would not be unreasonable for a court to require the functional equivalent of someone within the proceeding standing up in court or informing the department or informing one of the officers of the court in good faith that the child is a member of a tribe or that one of the child's parents is a member of the tribe. That, I believe, would be sufficient to trigger notice. But it can't just be that the child might be a member or that they perhaps could be a member if, in fact, a tribe could be found. That there's someone has to make a good faith showing that could be later investigated.
Well, that's why I'm exploring this with you. The words of the guideline is may be an Indian child. In other words, it sets forth in in the C under 67586. It sets forth circumstances under which a state court has reason to believe a child involved in a child custody proceeding is an Indian include but are not limited to the following. And underneath that, sub 5 is an officer of the court involved in the proceeding has knowledge that the child may be an Indian child. Do we have that in this record?
an officer of the court involved in the proceeding, advising the court that he or she has knowledge that the child may be an Indian child. Do we have that?
I don't think so. Based on the distance and lineage and the fact that the Indian ancestor invoked was born in Canada rather than the United States. Because, of course, Indian child, once again, belongs to a tribe that is eligible for services through the U.S. Department of the Interior. Tribes outside the United States, I believe, do not qualify under this. But I'm very glad you brought up the guidelines, because that's another issue I wanted to bring to the court's attention. It had not really...
Before you get on that other issue, and I don't want to, I just want to finish my thought on this. It seems to me that the definition of Indian child is under the Act, a member of an Indian tribe or is eligible for membership in an Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of an Indian tribe. So that's the definition. And you're saying, boy, before you even get the first base, you got to make sure that this child is properly, is really an Indian child under the definition of the Act.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. But then I look at the guidelines and say, okay, what do you need for that? And I look at, as I said, C, it says circumstances, it seems to me this is telling me maybe what you need. But I'm asking you to respond and tell me I'm wrong on this. C says, what do you need? Okay, you need circumstances under which a state court has reason to believe a child involved in the proceeding is an Indian child. And how do you show that? Well, they set out several circumstances which might be included but not limited to the following. And one of those, hey, if one of the attorneys raises their hand and says, Judge, I have knowledge that the child may be an Indian child. So that's where I'm going. Tell me what's wrong with that.
There's a really interesting difference in between the language of the statute and the language of the guidelines.
That's right.
And in fact, the guidelines are, of course, as this court has noted in the interest of DSB and the Court of Appeals noted in Brown County versus Marcella G, these guidelines are advisory. They're not binding on the court, but they are helpful and can be, it should be consulted. And in places where the statute leaves open something for definition, such as what constitutes an expert witness, they're very helpful.
What about what constitutes sufficient showing, given that the interpretation has to be liberal?
Well, if I could get back to the B1A. This is where the language of the guidelines deviates significantly from the statute, and I believe changes their meaning. And in a case like this, I would think that an advisory guideline would give way in weight to a mandatory statute. But the statute itself requires the trial court to give notice to the notice be provided if the trial court knows or has reason to know that the child is an Indian child. Right at the get-go in the Bureau of Indian Affairs guidelines, this has changed from reason to know to a reason to believe. That's in B1 sub A. Mm-hmm. And there is a vast difference between knowledge and belief. Knowledge implies certainty. Belief implies faith. If I say any one of us in this room believes in God, well, there's a lot to that. But we take it on a leap of faith. If I picked up this microphone and held it out and said I'm going to drop it, we would know what was going to happen because we know that the law of gravity in every case is going to make that thing fall. So, for some reason, the guideline proceeds on the basis that there's this reason to believe rather than the reason to know, and it takes a more liberal and expansive reading based on that change from the statutory language. So,
that's exactly what I'm getting at.
So what do we do?
Okay.
So I'm prior. All right.
I'm asking you, so what do we do?
So my question about having an evidentiary hearing on this issue, which is, you know, from what we can read, what this court has been supplied, is, you know, we could probably make a decision, but wouldn't a better way to handle this be to have the trial court make an initial decision as far as whether or not these, you know, the likely to be maybe Indian children right off the bat. And
yes, Your Honor, I think that would be a good idea. I think in general, in deciding these cases, whenever the Indian Child Welfare Act is invoked, the trial court early on should make a decision as to whether the federal law should be invoked or not.
Maybe in answering that question, you can answer Justice Bradley's question. What do you do when the federal statute and the guidelines differ?
If I were a judge, I would be following the statute.
And that, if I may, and that sounds so reasonable, but then I throw into the mix the mandate in all of this is to be construed liberally. And so I don't know, and the guidelines are to construe the statutes which are statutorily required to be construed liberally. So what do you do with that?
Yes, well, if you go back to the statute itself, even in 1901 in the congressional findings, it talks about how the United States has a direct interest in protecting Indian children who are members of or who are eligible for membership in an Indian tribe. It talks in terms of certainty that these children are members of a tribe. It does not talk of an overarching need to search for possible membership in a case such as this. Now, the reason that this is so important and that the stakes are so high and that this is so litigated is because the Indian Child Welfare Act imposes a minimum set of federal standards governing these types of proceedings which fundamentally alter the application of state law to a child custody proceeding such as this.
And the reason for the statute is to protect the heritage of this Indian child and protect the tribes to continue the heritage of the Indians rather than have massive numbers of children being put into a non-Indian homes. That's the goal, right?
Yes, Your Honor. This was enacted in 1978 in response to the wholesale removal of Indian children from their homes based on essentially white middle class standards, and it's been described as the most devastating destructive force on Indian tribes in the history of our nation.
And this statute may have unintended adverse consequences. It may not be accomplishing what it does. And if there's delay, the child is injured. That's a generally recognized proposition. You don't want the child in limbo for a length of time.
That's exactly the word.
Okay. Now, if I understood Justice Wilcox, he's saying, well, you've gotten a tip here. Maybe it's not reason to know. Maybe it's not even reason to believe. There's a tip here that there is some Indian connection, distant in time, distant in place, but something is said, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, does the trial judge ignore that? Is that your position? Judge even have to advise the BIA?
In this particular case, I don't think so.
Your position is this is a tip and you don't have to do anything because there's not enough here.
Well, given that these issues are supposed to be treated with caution, I believe the trial court did the right thing when the issue was first raised to investigate whether there was a possible connection. Once the department received information that the Indian ancestor was actually born in Canada, I don't think it was required to give any notice, either to the BIA or to anyone else.
But the Canadian thing just ended.
I think so.
I have trouble with that because you mean child is here the child of the mother and father, not of the grandparents or great-great-grandparents. So if the mother or father here were identified as an Indian and so recognized by the tribe, even though the great-great-great-grandmother was was Canadian, wouldn't that child still be eligible here as an Indian?
if the tribe that the parents were members of was eligible for services for the U.S., yes, then the Indian Child Welfare Act would apply, I believe.
So what's the matter with rating the 4 to 6 or whatever number of Chippewa tribes we have?
I guess a line has to be drawn somewhere early on as to what constitutes sufficient notice to the trial court. In this case, there was no good faith showing by any of the parties that any of the statutory criteria were met under 1912, I think.
So are you saying that sufficient notice means that you have to, that somebody has to say that the child is a member of, now looking for the definition, you have to go within the federal definition, is that it? You've got to say that, that the child is a member of an Indian tribe, or the child is eligible for membership in an Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of an Indian tribe.
Yes, that is what the federal law, I believe, requires. But if without those, that...
If those magic words are said and nothing else is said, then what does the court do?
Search. Send out notice to the tribes that are identified by the parties as the tribes that are the likely membership. As was noted as an exhibit in the back of the appellant's original brief, I believe it was page 7, this was the letter that was returned to the department by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It notes that it is the responsibility of the person claiming Indian ancestry to establish tribal affiliation. That's at the beginning of the second paragraph, it's exhibit 7. So the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I think, stakes out the requirements fairly well. It would not be sufficient for someone just to say, to have an amorphous statement of this statute applies. A tribe, I would think, logically speaking and looking at the meaning of the statute and everything else, would require some tribe to be identified.
Is there any evidence whatsoever that any of the bands of the Chippewa tribe had reservation land in Canada ever?
I have no idea. I know our District Attorney James Van Akron had researched the question of whether there were any Chippewa bands in Marinette, Wisconsin, which was the Wisconsin location that was given to us, and could not come up with any. And at that point, wrote to the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Well, if the burden is, was it the BIA who answered that question?
Yes.
Answered that letter. It is the responsibility of the person claiming Indian ancestry to establish tribal affiliation. They could have at least researched whether anyone of the Chippewa bands had ever had reservation land. It's almost inconceivable to me that a Chippewa band in the United States that would qualify as a tribe under the statute would have had reservation land in Canada.
Well, once again, to get back to the threshold statutory definition, nobody had ever alleged either that the children's father belonged to an Indian tribe in the United States, or that the children themselves belonged or were eligible for membership. And that, I think, is the starting point for the discussion, for the notice provisions, for a search.
But could I ask this? Did the District Attorney's Office in Sheboygan County dig in its heels and take a position that it was not going to ship these children off to a tribal court under any circumstances?
I have never heard that. I have never read that any place.
What would Mr. Provost say was your greatest failing in complying with the act, federal act?
I think Mr. Provost, as he has indicated earlier, would have liked us to send notice to the 6 Chippewa tribes in Wisconsin. I think, I'm guessing. that that would be what we should have done somehow.
Chippewa tribes in the UP, and there are Chippewa tribes, I think, in Minnesota. I mean, do you have to wait? When you're operating under the best interest of the child standard under Wisconsin law, do you have to wait for all the returns to come in from these far precincts?
Well, I believe there's a 10-day limit, and then the tribes have, and if they've responded within the 10 days, then they have an additional 20 days to prepare a response to the court. So it's not that long of a turnaround, but as I was mentioning earlier, the federal minimum standards do significantly prohibit the action of the state statutes in a case of a child who meets the federal statutory definition of an Indian child but is not domiciled on the reservation. So where one of these actions has taken place in a state court, the child is an Indian child, and perhaps the tribe, for whatever reason, has declined jurisdiction, so the matter stays in state court. It pretty much renders the action of the TPR statutes 48.415 and the rest of it irrelevant unless it can also be proven. It raises the standard of proof from clear and convincing evidence to beyond a reasonable doubt. And just to give a hypothetical, say if there was a child and termination proceedings had been started, then the tribe had declined to intervene or to assume jurisdiction, and a jury had come back unanimously finding that let's pick a ground for termination that has nothing to do with this case, and so let's say a continuing parental disability. If a jury came back with a unanimous verdict by clear and convincing evidence that termination grounds had been established, and that at a fact-finding hearing, the trial judge determined that the best interest of the child warranted removal from the parent, that could still not take place unless there was also a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that continued placement with the parent would result in the likelihood of severe emotional or physical harm or damage to the child. So conceivably, if you want to take this hypothetical to the worst case scenario, you could have a Wisconsin court not allowed to terminate parental rights beyond a reasonable doubt, it was only established that the child would suffer moderate physical harm or significant emotional damage. It has to be severe. So it is a large burden that the federal statute places on the state court when it applies. I think it is not unreasonable for this court in Wisconsin to require somewhat of a symmetry of duties or burdens to make the application of the statute contingent on more than just an allegation that the child might be an Indian child, that somehow a good faith statement that the child is a member of
the guidelines don't say that.
No, the guidelines don't say that.
The statute doesn't put a burden on anyone.
That's true.
No. I just want to make sure I have the facts right concerning this good faith effort that the judge found. If I recall the facts, there was a suggestion that the relative was an Ojibwe Indian. And then the county contacted the BIA to see if an Ojibwe Indian from the Marinette area. And I think the county surfed the net to see if there were any Ojibwe tribe in Marinette and found none. Sent to the BIA and asked for Ojibwe tribe in the Marinette area and found none. Contacted their local BIA office and they didn't have any Ojibwe tribe in Marinette, so they found one. None. Looked in their juvenile court handbook, which lists Indian tribes in Wisconsin, and they did not list an Ojibwa tribe in Marinette. So then they come back to a hearing before the court because the father filed a motion asking the court to order the county to notify specific tribes. And Judge Murphy says, hey, I own property in Marinette. You know, and another name for Ojibwe is Chippewa. Isn't that what happened here? Or do I have the facts wrong on that?
Sounds right.
Okay. And so all of those efforts about Ojibwa to the BIA locally, to the BIA nationally, surfing the net, I mean, aren't they kind of for naught? Because and there was a request that the Chippewa be notified, and then the judge, and I'm asking this in a bit of an argumentative way, but I'm not sure I'm right at all, so I want you to respond. But the judge says, well, I think they've made every reasonable effort, and it caused me concern to think, well, they made every reasonable effort, but they asked the wrong tribe.
Well,
it wasn't until Murphy said, hey, I have property there. Ojibwa is just another name for Chippewa. So
well,
how do you respond to that?
Two parts to my answer. Without Mr. Van Akron here, unfortunately, he could not make it from Sheboygan today. I do not know whether he surfed the net under both Ojibwa and Chippewa Indians. It would not surprise me if an internet search turned up both search terms in the same results. But in terms of whether Judge Murphy was correct in saying that sufficient notice had been given, it's our position that no notice was required in the first place. Once the information was received by the department, that all we knew was that the great-great-grandmother of the children was born in Canada.
I refer you to page 13 of the transcript of the hearing where Attorney Van Akron is saying that an additional effort to find an Ojibwa tribe in Marinette, I searched the internet for any reference to them. After that the court then says, just a paragraph or two after that, and he says he reviewed, Mr. Van Akron says he reviewed the juvenile handbook regarding any Ojibwa tribe listed in Marinette County. And there was no way of notifying any Ojibwe tribe in Marinette County, he concludes. And then the court says, I don't know either, but I'm fairly familiar with Marinette, Wisconsin, having some property in Marinette. There certainly are Chippewa, which is another name for Ojibwe. So that just caused me concern.
I'm going to go on a limb here, and assume that the Bureau of Indian Affairs would be familiar with Ojibwa equating with Chippewa, and also that the local office in Fort Snelling, Minnesota would somehow understand that the Chippewa was an anglicized version of Ojibwa, but I couldn't say that with any certainty of my life. I'm just thinking that an agency that would be familiar with the multiple Indian affairs of the nation would know that.
As I understand the cases, some of them require the party asserting the applicability of the Indian Child Welfare Act, that that party, here the father, would have to prove that the children are Indian children and do something before we'd send out notice. That's your position, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But there are many other cases that say that the party seeking termination ought to send out the notice if the court has any reason to believe, and that's under the guidelines, that the child is Indian. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's two schools of thought. No consensus across the country.
You're proposing the first school of thought.
Yes,
which puts a burden on the party asserting the Indian heritage and makes it harder then to get information about the child and determine whether the child is an Indian so that if the tribal court wants jurisdiction, it can take it. Now, how does that square with the goal of the act?
Well, the goal of the Act is, of course, to promote the best interest of the Indian child and also to promote the stability of the tribes. And in, I would say, the majority of these matters, the children involved are already residents of domiciled on the Indian reservations. And so the tribe automatically flexes its jurisdiction in most cases.
But here we don't have that.
Here we don't have
that. That case is easy.
Right. The Indian Child Welfare Act was never meant to apply to every child with a drop of Indian blood. It was applied, It was meant to apply to those, I believe, with tangible Indian connections. Now, that's not to say...
No, it says member of an Indian tribe, which if an Indian tribe takes a drop of Indian blood and that's a member, that's good enough, right?
Yes.
But if it requires more than that, it's up to the Indian tribe.
It's up to the tribe. Right.
Thank you, counsel. Rompus, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I won't respond specifically to anything because it's the hour is getting late, but I just wanted to stress, maybe it doesn't need to be stressed, that I'm not gainsaying or criticizing their office. I think they made their best effort to comply with what they believed the statute provided. What I'm saying is here, the statute requires more, requires an actual tribe to have the opportunity to decide whether or not they're going to intervene. And if no tribe ever gets the notice, no matter what they did, it just can't possibly be right. So unless people have further questions for me.
Hearing none?
Submitted.
Done.
Thank you.
That concludes the hearing on 02-0574.